Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Well, I'm warning right now that this is one of the longest editions of In the Green Outdoors that I've ever presented. But there's a lot to say this time of year, so we'll get right to it. Remember that you always can catch the whole show on demand at our website. Since garden centers have been full of people choosing bedding plants and adding perennials to their pollinator gardens, let's talk a bit about flower cultivars, color, and how color is perceived by humans versus birds and insects. Also, when choosing your plants, how to consider the pollinators that you hope to attract, if that is something of interest to you. Petunias are incredibly popular bedding, container, and hanging basket plants, loved for their variously colored and patterned flowers that bloom freely till frost. Despite the long blooming window, have you ever noticed that petunias never seem to attract many pollinators? Reason for that is that hybrid petunias have very little nectar. Also, when choosing coneflowers for insects, not just any echinacea variety will do. Double cultivars like Pink Double Delight, Secret Desire, and Puff Vanilla have heavily modified flower heads. Where normally the dome center is filled with tiny orangish-brown florets, in double coneflowers these are remade into a pom-pom of fluffy petals, and pollinators cannot access nectar that, in some cases, may not even be there. The straight species are always the best for pollinators. Low pollen flowers include snapdragons, zinnias, cosmos, and lupins. These flowers provide aesthetic value while lacking bee visits due to their reduced pollen production. Butterflies, on the other hand, absolutely love zinnias, which offer an abundant supply of high-quality nectar. These vibrant annuals are considered one of the best, easiest-to-grow plants for attracting butterflies like monarchs, swallowtails, and painted ladies to a garden. Also, their flat, daisy-like centers provide the perfect, easy-to-access landing pad for nectar. Butterflies like a platform and nectar tubes for their long tongues and are most attracted to any colors but blue and green. Speaking of blue, queen bumblebees are the principal pollinators of Virginia bluebells in early spring. This lovely spring ephemeral is not confined to Virginia or my backyard, but grows throughout the eastern United States, even up into northern Quebec and Ontario. The flower buds of Virginia bluebells are a vibrant pink due to a pigment called anthocyanin. When the flower is ready for pollination, a chemical increases the alkalinity of the flower, changing the color to blue. Several other species in this borage family do the same. The flowers of spotted lungwort, or pulmonaria, which provide an early nectar source for bees, and the herbs comfrey and, of course, borage. The color change depends on flower age and, unlike some other flower species, are not triggered by the number of insect visits, pollination, or fertilization. Pollinators prefer the bright pink flowers, but the plants retain the older flowers that have turned blue, making the floral display larger and easier for pollinators to spot from a distance. Once these arrive, they will choose the pink flowers for their nectar reward, with pollen ready to be transferred to the fertile stigma. Many color-changing flowers shift in hue as their blooms age and mature. One is Hibiscus mutabilis, often called Confederate rose. The species name mutabilis is Latin for change and refers to the flowers that transition from white when they first open to shades of pink and then to deep red, all within one day. Throughout the season, each shade of flower can be found on the plant, making it particularly ornamental. Bees use scent and vision to find appropriate flowers. Humans have three types of cone cells, red, green, and blue. The compound eyes of bees have three color receptors that can see yellow and orange and combinations of blue, green, and ultraviolet, or UV. They see red as black, and they pass any of those flowers by. Importantly, since their sight includes the ultraviolet spectrum, it means that they also perceive iridescence. That is the quality of flower petals changing color depending on the angle of view. Many flowers have evolved structures that are visible in the UV range. Also, note that bees tend to prefer disc-shaped flowers that have easily accessible nectar. Birds also see a much richer, more complex spectrum of colors than do we humans. This is because birds, like bees, have receptors that perceive UV light. Bees also find flowers by scent. A bee's olfactory system is about 100 times more sensitive than a human's, allowing them to detect the sweet, volatile compounds of floral scents as far as a few kilometers away. Since bees ignore red flowers and birds have no sense of smell, there's no reason for red flowers to be fragrant. But unlike bees, birds definitely are attracted to red flowers. Red flowers often are those most visited by hummingbirds, as most people know, and often are tubular. And this is why hummingbird feeders usually are at least partly red. Some small and long-tongued bees also like tubular flowers. Although there are some plants with green flowers, since bees prefer bright colors, they rarely are attracted to these. An exception is Bells of Ireland, whose nectar-rich, cup-shaped blooms act as natural bee feeders. By the way, Bells of Ireland actually is native to Turkey, Syria, and the Caucasus. The name likely was coined by marketers associating the green spikes with luck and St. Patrick's Day. In any case, most green flowers, including grasses, typically are pollinated by wind or by beetles and flies. White flowers, of course, will attract nighttime pollinators, including bats. Such flowers often change to dull red, gold, or purple after having been pollinated, and thus they fade into the darkness. Yet they still may release fragrance, helping to guide more visitors to the remaining flowers. Experiments show that bees avoid white flowers when these comprise less than 25% of the flower population. But this discrimination disappears when white flowers comprise 50% or more of the population. Brown and dark maroon flowers often have a rank fragrance that appeals to flies. Pawpaw and wild ginger are two examples. These blossoms emit a faint odor of rotting meat, yeast, or fermenting fruit. This odor, combined with the dark purple-maroon color, targets carrion beetles, blowflies, and midges that crawl inside the flowers expecting food. But, alas, these flowers offer no nectar, only pollen that then is transferred from flower to flower as the insects search in vain for food. A few moments ago, I mentioned the alkalinity of young Virginia bluebell flowers being the reason for their pink color upon opening. Many people choose hydrangeas for their yards and manipulate the pH, that is, the acidity or alkalinity of the soil, in order to make pink flowers blue or blue flowers pink. While hydrangeas grow in acidic soils produce brilliant true blue blooms, more alkaline soils may result in flowers that are shades of bright pink. Making use of color-changing flowers in the landscape is a way to add interest to perennial flower beds. While these types of flowers most often occur on various types of shrubs and bushes, the flowers of some annual and perennial plants also do change color. Another example of color change resulting from pH manipulation is the wild violet jelly that I've made. After steeping flowers packed into a large measuring cup, I strain them out of the now pale blue water. Next, add a small quantity of lemon juice to the liquid, not so much for flavor, but to turn the pale blue to a lovely bright pink before proceeding with the requisite addition of commercial pectin to produce the final product. There's so much more to learn about flower color, but we'll leave it for another time, since I want to end this week's program the way I ended my last program, by mentioning a few more May holidays and their significance to gardening or ecology. May 24th is National Asparagus Day. Asparagus used to be classified as a member of the lily family, along with the alliums, such as garlic and onions. But genetic research now places lilies, alliums, and asparagus in three separate families, with amaryllis and asparagus grouped together in the order Asparagalis. May 27th marks the birthday of Rachel Carson in 1907, the courageous writer, ecologist, and marine biologist, most often known for her 1962 book, Silent Spring, in which she alerted all of us to the dangers to wildlife of all kinds of pesticides, and most famously, DDT. May 29th is designated Learn About Composting Day. Need I say more? Well, not for now, but in September, I will be presenting a program on that very topic at the Marion Public Library. Check the library's online calendar for the date and time. On Memorial Day, a holiday established soon after the Civil War, we remember the soldiers who have died defending our country. Originally called Decoration Day, the subsequent world wars turned it into a generalized day of remembrance. Its symbol is the wild red poppy, immortalized by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, a physician in the Canadian Expeditionary Force, who in 1915 wrote the famous poem, In Flanders Fields. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with at least the opening lines. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow, beneath the crosses row on row. All poppies belong to the same genus, Papaver, but there are numerous species, some annual, some perennial. The poppies growing in wild in Flanders fields commonly are called corn poppies. These are not opium poppies, but Mediterranean natives that grow in cultivated fields all over southern Europe, far beyond the northern Dutch-speaking region of Belgium's Flanders. Opium poppies, which come in a wide variety of colors and petal appearance, also are annual poppies. These legally may be grown in American gardens, and the seed is collected for food, but needless to say, it is not legal to use these plants for the production of opium. All of these annual types of poppies will self-sow readily. Once the pods have matured, the least breeze will scatter the seeds, so if you want to catch those for baking, be ready to harvest them as soon as the pods are brown and the tiny window-like apertures at the top have opened. Using pruning shears, carefully clip the stems without bending them, and have a paper bag ready in which to collect the stems, inverting them so the pods face down. Even with care, it's inevitable that a number of the seeds are going to escape you, ensuring another crop late next spring. Harvested seeds maintain their culinary flavor and quality for quite some time when stored in a cool, dark place. However, seed viability is lost quickly, and the seeds intended for replanting should not be stored for more than a year. Of course, the pods themselves make for an interesting addition to dried arrangements. Perennial poppies include oriental poppies, Papaver orientale, native to the Caucasus, northern Turkey, and northern Iran. The foliage appears in fairly early spring as an enthusiastic mound of hairy, deeply cut leaves, quickly followed by crepe paper-like flowers, most commonly bright orange, but also available in red, pink, or white. The California poppy, also called golden poppy, Mexican poppy, California sunlight, or cup of gold, is native to the United States and Mexico. While it's in the same family, it's a different genus and species than the other poppies that I've just mentioned. While pictures of fields of California poppies generally show red flowers, they may be orange or yellow, and occasionally pink or white. Finally, a brief update on invasive plants blooming now. The eye-catching pink, purple, and white flowering Dame's Rocket may be seen along roadsides and ditches in Ohio. Hesperus matronalis resembles our native phlox, but there are a few key differences. As a member of the mustard family, the flowers of Dame's Rocket have four petals, while our native phlox has five. Also, Dame's Rocket leaves are alternate along the stems, while those of phlox are opposite. This plant has been classified as an invasive species because it spreads and reduces biodiversity. Like most invasive plants in North America, Dame's Rocket lacks natural predators and diseases. It's a fast-growing and prolific cedar and thrives in a variety of environments. Its spread has been accelerated by its inclusion in so-called wildflower seed mixes sold commercially. As stated on the Ohio Department of Agriculture's website, quote, "No person shall sell, offer for sale, propagate, distribute, import, or intentionally cause the dissemination of any invasive plant in Ohio." Be on the lookout and beware of nurseries that may sell plants labeled wild phlox. And now it's also time to be on the lookout for poison hemlock and wild parsnip. I've seen the yellow umbels of hemlock blooming already along the edge of a barren field. I haven't seen parsnip in bloom yet, but it's there, and it won't be long. Well, there's much more that I wish I had time for today, but I'm really out of time. Suffice to say that I'm glad that I cautiously kept putting off planting my young potted nightshade family plants and tender perennials outdoors. They all survived the wind, rain, and mid-40 overnight temperatures we had this past week, sheltered in the relative comfort of our enclosed porch. Well, I hope all of your new plants made it through as well. And this is Carol Kelly saying, it's time to plant my summer vegetable plants into the raised bed summer home here in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it. Thank you for listening.